If I could just ask the other speakers to come up, we're just going to have a few minutes for questions. Michelle, while they're organising themselves, I'm interested that the guidelines have gone so heavily for the use of FibroScan in this setting, because the liver is a capacitance organ in hemodialysis patients means that the elastographic qualities of it change radically during dialysis. Have you got any sort of additional information about when it should be done and how it should be interpreted?
I did not capture every single word, but if I understood well your question, to what extent the hydration status of the patient is modifies the reliability of the FibroScan.
Yeah.
Now, at least there have been not 20, but 3 studies, and none of them compared FibroScan before or after dialysis or similar studies. That would be interesting to perform. But still, in some, I would say perhaps large size studies of kidney transplant recipients, most of them on dialysis from the US, from if I recall, Taiwan and Europe, consistently detecting there were very few cases of advanced liver fibrosis that were missed. So I think the key issue is that. Otherwise, you may have F1, F2, but missing F4 with FibroScan, which is, in my opinion, and the opinion of the work group, is better than the biochemical marker.
Because we looked at it in 70 patients presented at ASN, and it changes a lot, and we did concomitant liver MR to look at total liver water as well. So it's interesting how that interaction is going to be. I think you're certainly, if you have an abnormal FibroScan, then as a trigger to treat, that's probably not unreasonable. So we go to the cards phrase for you, Michelle, again. What about treating people who are Hep C and Hep B positive together? How do the guidelines handle that?
Together, you mean at the same time?
Why not? Yeah, well, a lot of these patients are co-infected.
I would say the field of virology is moving, so treating Hep C, the field has changed enormously in 5 years. I would say a first comment is that if you treat one, there have been, even though I'm a nephrologist, like people in the audience, not a hepatologist, but there have been case reports showing that if you treat one virus, the other may reactivate. So people who are dually positive, let's say, for Hep B and Hep C at least, you should carefully follow liver function tests and virological markers during treatment if they are... I would prefer personally to treat one and then the other, but there is no objection against considering treating both.
So, Fratari, you mentioned your concept of renal reserve, which obviously spoken about for a long time and I think has got a lot of core truth to it. But somebody asked a question, how would you evaluate renal reserve?
First of all, I think that there's being a revitalized interest for renal function reserve because there is a better understanding that you may lose nephrons without losing baseline GFR levels, and therefore there is a need to do something that is done for the lungs and for the heart, which is a kind of a kidney stress test. The kidney stress test can only be performed if you try to exploit the maximum capacity of filtration of the kidney, which is different from the baseline GFR. There is a nice paper on nephron and also in clinical nephrology recently that well described how renal function reserve test is performed, which is basically with an acute oral protein loading or with an IV amino acid infusion. We are also searching the possibility to use other means, including the study of renal resistances at the ultrasound, and also the possibility to use specific drugs to elicit maximum filtration response. It is a test that is not precise at 1%, at 100%. It needs to be interpreted. However, it gives you a great deal of information. For example, we just recently published a paper showing that you should evaluate renal functional reserve before allowing people to become donor for living-related donor. If they don't have renal functional reserve, how do you allow to donate a kidney?
or in ladies that wish to become pregnant and they are using renal function reserve in the last trimester of the pregnancy, they must have renal function reserve in order to cope with the increased demand of renal function. The overall concept of renal function reserve and renal stress testing is now getting more and more attention. I think that in elective patients, like we did in cardiac surgery patients before receiving elective cardiac surgery, you can do an oral protein loading and test renal function reserve. In the acute condition, like in the ICU, is more difficult, and what is required probably is more immediate pharmacological or ultrasound study to analyze this.
And how dynamic do you think it is? I mean, if you have a reduction in renal function reserve from drugs, for instance, have you systematically looked at if you alter those drugs, do they recover renal function reserve?
Basically, renal reserve is the difference between the maximum capacity of the kidney and the baseline. So when patients have lost nephrons, they are not able to recover maximum capacity. You may recover renal functional reserve, for example, if you have a patient that has a baseline GFR of 100 and a maximum GFR of 120. If you give a vegetarian diet to that patient, his baseline GFR may go down to 70 or 80, and the differential to the maximum capacity increase, so you increase the renal functional reserve. Nevertheless, you do not affect the maximum capacity.
Someone was very intrigued. How do you keep your cells alive on the membrane?
So what you need to do, of course, is you need to have a very well-defined protocol because, as you remember, then you have to culture the cells on the fibers and then you have to treat them with the culture medium for a few days. So basically the site where we call it as an urine site, this is the one that you also have now the culture medium. So the cells getting oxygen and nutrients from the site. So when you see the fibers and the cells are cultured on the outside, so you have your blood or plasma coming on the inside. On the outside, you have a culture medium. But of course, what I did not have time to mention is you need to have a very well-defined protocol of culturing the cells, make sure they are attached for a few hours, do some perfusion regime so the cells get the right orientation, right?
Yeah.
And then you do the effect. Yes. So what we noticed is we have reliable data that the cells function well for up to 2 weeks. Under this condition.
Because maintaining adherence has always been a technical challenge in
yes.
the past.
Yes. So what was often the case is because of the not good cell adhesion, then you have detachment after a certain period of time, especially under flow. Another case was that the function was going down, so then you don't really have the transport that you anticipate for a longer period of time. This has to do a lot with the cell lines that have been used, so we think that the new cell line we have been working on, it is more reliable, but I think we have to discuss more when we have more data, more than a few weeks in this case.
And when you've got your mixed matrix
okay.
activated carbon, what's the total absorptive capacity of that kind of system?
Well, that is a good question because it depends. It depends what type of molecule you like to remove. So perhaps I mentioned that those particles are porous. So you can tailor the porosity and then you can tailor the accessibility to the porosity. So they have some of them internal surface area of around 2,000 grams of molecules per square meter. Okay? So there is... 1,000 square meters per gram of those particles. So there is, for small molecules, you can remove or you can absorb a lot high amounts. What we've noticed in this case is, of course, there is also competitive absorption. So when you have a mixture of molecules that they can absorb, activated carbon is not very selective, absorbs creatinine and other molecules. So there is always a competition. So what you can tailor is, you can tailor the surface area by tailoring the way you make your particles. So we have now in progress some research where we can create particles with two different porosities, small pores and bigger pores, and each one of these pores has its internal surface area in the order of a few thousand square meters per gram of particles. But you incorporate these particles to a matrix, and you want to make sure that the matrix is hosting the particles without basically blocking the surface area of the particles. So it is very important the polymer matrix around the particles is also open enough, allowing you that.
So do you end up trading off middle molecular clearance against the ability to clear protein bound, or do you get reasonable middle molecular clearance as well?
Oh, you see, what you in the membrane that I've mentioned as membrane matrix 1.0, we have relatively big pores. So albumin-bound toxins can even reach the particles. What we realized, the pore size of the particles was quite smaller, so albumin cannot get in to the pores, but it could pass through the internal layer and go to the particles. In the second case, we have baked the internal internal membrane with smaller pores, so albumin could not go through. And therefore, you will see an increased removal of molecules which are smaller than this. So we have now a new generation of particles that we can remove creatinine, indoxy sulfate, picrocy sulfate, beta-2M, and some of IL-8 and IL-6, which is larger molecules, because you have the right balance in this case. So it is quite a tailoring process, but I think...
This is great, by the way, because I can sound smart because you give me some really clever questions to ask people. It's really good. One last question before we go and get some coffee, I think. So to Claudia and everyone, really, which is, what's the most important post-ICU care that we as nephrologists could give for acute kidney injury? What's the follow-on for those people who do get out of ICU, who've suffered it? It's a big question. That's why I thought we'd leave it alone. So as nephrologists, do we have functional recovery and we sign off? You know, if there isn't a specific need for us to be involved monitoring their CKD or their dialysis requirement, should we still be involved and how might we be involved?
Okay, I'll tell you what we try to do. What we try to do is to create an AKD clinic. AKD stands for acute kidney disease, which means we follow the patient possibly 3 months later discharge from the ICU or from one episode of AKI. Because of the 3 months is the time in which recovery may occur and is entitled to be defined as recovery from an acute kidney injury episode, or if the renal dysfunction remains, you enter the condition of chronic kidney disease. What we try to do is to design in our hospital the AKD clinic, which is basically at the moment of discharge of the patient from the hospital, a visit planned at 3 months with renal function and different screening. And it seems that our paper on cardiac surgery patient show an interesting result, which is even patients who got high biomarkers without having creatinine change, which is called subclinical AKI today, at 3 months seems to have a reduced renal functional reserve. Probably we should promote the idea that not only baseline GFR should be tested, but also renal functional reserve.
Because these people are often heavy users of our services, aren't they? I mean, many of these people will come back and have 4 cardiac stents put in and get contrast nephropathy, etc.
Right, yeah. Right. You know, if you admit that if you have 1 million nephrons, and you lose 2 nephrons, you start your process towards chronic kidney disease, although it's very early. But if you have 1 million minus 2, it's not the same thing of having 1 million. So that patient is, theoretically speaking and practically speaking, more susceptible to any type of insult in developing AKI.
I think that's the key issue, isn't it? Because it's injury begets more injury, doesn't it?
Right.
Yeah. Well, if there's no more questions, I'll just bring this defiantly European session to an end. Thank you very much again to the speakers, and thanks for your...